That's me, that's Nanny, that's Mummy, and that's you.
Why do I look so sad?
That's what your face looks like.
Welcome to Real Lit. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Mackenzie.
A very British Mackenzie today, apparently.
Oh, yes. It's my favorite way to be.
Notice I barely tried because I'm nothing like that. She over here is like Gwyneth Paltrow. Could have sworn she was from the UK.
No, I know. My husband, he'll eat beans for breakfast, so maybe we are British.
Maybe you're bound to be an expat at some point.
Possibly.
So how's everything going?
It's going great. It's October. You know, October is one of the craziest times of the year, I think.
It certainly has been for us.
Yes.
We went down a rabbit hole last Saturday. And
oh, yeah. Fell right down it. I really fell. Hit my head.
We dressed up as Alice in Wonderland characters in our department, for those of you who don't know.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. We had really great characters. We were able to have the Cheshire Cat, that was Stephen, and I was Alice, and we had a Mad Hatter and a Red Queen and the rabbit.
Yep, and we won first prize at Halloween. So
yes, I told all my classes, all Yay my students.
Yay for the English department. We got the golden pumpkin.
Yes, I was like, we win fall.
And since it is October, for two more days at any rate, we would be remiss if we did not have a very extra special Halloween edition of Real Lit.
Yes, you have to do a ghost story. I just don't see how you couldn't. So we're doing The Woman in Black this week.
That's correct.
And it's interesting to think about this movie when it came out, and I hadn't read the book yet. And so when it came out, I really, really enjoyed the like snips I saw from the movie, but I didn't watch the full thing. I don't know why. I just saw all these random clips and I was like, oh, that's really cool. What a neat story. And I never watched the full film until last week when we were preparing for this.
I was at the theater. This was, of course, 2012 when the film came out. And the year before, a very obscure film came out starring Daniel Radcliffe. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, I think it was called.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
But, yeah, of course, he played Harry Potter for, what, eight films, right?
Yes.
And here he is now suddenly playing an adult and also playing someone who's supposed to be afraid of ghosts as opposed to, you know, living with nearly headless Nick and moaning Myrtle. But I did find it interesting, if you watch the DVD commentary, the director, James Watkins, says, you know, that very first scene where we see him, he's shaving. And he's like, that's deliberate because we had to let the audience say, hey, this is a grown man. It's not the boy who lived anymore. It's the man who, well, didn't live, spoiler alert.
Right.
But it's interesting you mentioned that. I actually read the book first because my master's thesis, of course, deals with Victorian Gothic fiction. And this is not Victorian, but you'd swear it was.
Yes, absolutely.
When somebody told me about it, and when I picked it up, I was like, holy cow, are you sure this wasn't written in like 1920 at least? No, surely, 1983.
Yeah, when I was writing about it, I had to keep reminding myself, like, this is not 1890, you know, 1915. This is 1983. And I just kept having to remind myself of that when I kept writing certain words like Victorian, or even sometimes when I wrote Gothic. I was like, is it? I mean, it is. But it's not that Edgar Allan Poe era that we think
it's
about.
It's certainly Gothic.
Yeah.
It's pseudo-Victorian. It's a word I'm going to say a lot, so get used to it. So we talk about the differences between the book and the film?
Yes, I will say something that we haven't really seen yet that I really like about this combo is the sanctity of names. You know, they kept all the names.
No Tristrans?
Much. No Tristrans. And so I really liked that. It's just one of those small things that makes me really happy. But other than that, like, at the very beginning, major differences, and at the very end, major differences.
Right.
Especially in terms of this marriage that our main character Arthur has. You know, in the book, he's engaged to be married when he leaves. And then in the film, his wife dies during childbirth. So they've been married for a little while. And it really changes the dynamic of how you see Arthur, for sure.
Absolutely. I wonder, because when I read, first time I read The Woman in Black, all I could think was Dracula. Like, she's paying homage because he gets on a train, he goes to, not another country, but to the countryside where the people are kind of weird, and there's that passage about, like, any woman who's a little different would be considered a witch, you know, and it's a very similar way that Harker felt when he moved into Transylvania, but also, of course, Harker leaves his fiancée Mina behind.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if Arthur Kipps, leaving his fiancée, he's a solicitor, just like Harker was, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if part of that was kind of like an homage to Dracula as well, which the film just decided to throw out for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And I assume it's a way to emotionally invest us in Arthur a little bit more than in the book. Because while I am invested in the book, you know, when there's a protagonist whose spouse passes in the beginning of the movie, you're immediately empathetic towards them. And so I think it was very effective. It was a very effective choice, but it changed how I viewed Arthur's character throughout the entire film.
It at least gives Daniel Radcliffe a moment to show off his acting chops. I guess it's
absolutely. I thought he did fantastic.
Yeah, and it's harder to play a grieving widower than it is a starry-eyed, engaged person who's
yes.
just looking to make that first little bit to marry his sweetheart. So,
and then in the film, since they are married, they've been married for a little while, they have a son who's 4 years old in the time that we see in the film after the wife passes from childbirth. And so in the novella, he doesn't have a son yet. You know, it happens at the very end.
Right.
And so then you get the little kid playing on your heartstrings at the very beginning.
Which, by the way, is Daniel Radcliffe's godson, the actor who plays him.
Very, very cool.
Watkins cast him because he thought they would have chemistry. Who knew? You know, you mm-hmm. and your godfather might have a little bit of chemistry. But I thought that kid was great.
Yes, he
adorable.
Was.
Adorable.
He was very cute.
He's how old now?
Oh, goodness. I don't know.
He's probably driving or, who knows, drinking.
I mean, that father aspect really does change him in the beginning, right? Especially going into the woman in black who preys on children. It gives him a completely different outlook. And I do think that there's a heavy difference in the characterization of Arthur in that in the film, he's already susceptible to the supernatural. He's already willing to believe in those forces. And then in the book, he's, you know, he doesn't go into it thinking there's going to be a ghost. He's not necessarily a skeptic, but he's not aware.
He might be skeptic. You know, that's a very common trope in Victorian literature to have the skeptic go, yeah, there's no such thing that could be explained away. And then, of course, that person's going to get a shock, if not killed, by
yeah.
whatever supernatural thing it is. Do we want to go ahead and get out of the way?
The ending?
The ending?
The ending is so different. I do really like the ending of the film. It's extremely morbid. It's extremely sad. But they went together, you know. Arthur and his son died together and were reunited with the mother. And so I like to see that where in the novella, Arthur's just left alone. His wife and his child die before his eyes, and then he's alone.
Yeah, the novella is so much darker.
It is.
Even though he lives with that guilt of having seen his wife and son both perish.
Right.
At the hands of the woman in black, whereas that's a kind of a touching, almost cheesy scene at the end.
Yeah.
Do it. Do your British voice.
Daddy, who is that lady over there?
That's your mother.
And I'm like, because at first I thought it might be the woman in black. And I was like, no, she's going to come take him. But no, it was the wife. And so I enjoyed to see that just because the whole movie is so dark that little bit of light I felt was tastefully done.
Literally in white. She's the woman in white.
Yeah.
And this is, as I will talk about a little bit, a film with a lot of parallels like that. What else are we missing? Oh, let's talk about the structure of the book. Speaking
yes.
of Victorian. So we have a Christmas story, for starters. Arthur has remarried. He's got some stepchildren. This is, a lot of people don't know this. Speaking of Halloween, Christmas Eve is just about that same level in a lot of England. You get together, you tell ghost stories by the fire. If you think about it, probably the most famous ghost story in all of Victorian literature.
A Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol, which takes place
Love
at Christmas.
One.
So that was a very common tradition, what they're doing. They're getting together telling these ghost stories, but Arthur, having lived through this, kind of sees it as not as amusing as the others. So he basically, runs out of the room, right? Has to get his bearings
yeah.
together. But then he decides to sit down and write his story, just to kind of put it on paper and show why he's adverse to these kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get this flashback. That's such a common trope in so much of Victorian literature. You think about Frankenstein.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the captain on the ship telling the story that Victor told him. So you have these multiple layers in this nested narrative.
Yeah, and he says not to read the book until after he's passing. And I do think
right.
that kind of that multiple translation, maybe that builds on the idea of the unknown, you know, the obscurity, maybe in a way. But it is definitely a huge commonality in these types of novels.
Even Dracula is so groundbreaking in that way, in that there's so many different people read so many diaries and
mm-hmm.
the recordings of Seward, and it's not that complex of a narrative, but it is that very common trope of here's a story being written by someone else and being told by someone else. I mean, Jekyll Hyde does that.
Yeah.
A lot of Arthur Machen, others, you see that quite commonly. So again, kudos to Susan Hill for picking up on that and giving us that style of narrative.
Absolutely.
You can't do that really in a film, though, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it would be extremely challenging. And then there's also a difference in the perception of the townspeople, which I think is important to note. Just a little bit more like how in the novel they are standoffish, but they're not hostile. You know, and in the movie, they are entirely hostile.
I can see why.
Yes, they think, absolutely.
They think their children are going to start dying again. I get that.
Absolutely.
Any others that we want to talk about?
I think that's really the biggest ones. Other than, so the relationship between Alice and Jeanette is different in the fact that in the novella, Jeanette dies from quote-unquote a disease, like kind of a natural cause of death, right? And then in the movie, she dies from suicide, from hanging herself. And that's because Alice forcibly took Jeanette's child in the film. Right, forcibly adopted this child against Jeanette's will, while in the book, Jeanette had a consensual knowledge of this adoption.
She wasn't happy about it.
She wasn't happy about it, but she knew it was going to happen, and she wasn't actively working against it in such a literal, almost violent kind of way. You know, so I think that difference in death also is a huge characterization difference for Jeanette.
It almost seems more prime to be a haunting if she took her own life.
Right. And going into our close read, particularly thinking about these kind of images that change our viewpoints, it was very challenging for me to decide on one specific aspect to analyze for my close read. And I tend to veer towards Gothic criticism, in case anyone didn't know. Particularly regarding characterization, I love archetypes, I love character analysis. So this time I wanted to focus instead on motif symbolism within the book. Because while the imagery is stark in the film, because you can see it visually, it's the descriptive language and foreshadow that brings the motifs into focus in the novella. While it is the most obvious, I feel like I first need to discuss the woman in black, right? Sometimes it's hard to talk about her because she's the title, so it's, you know, obvious.
Duh.
Yeah, yeah. Right? But she really is an essential motif for the themes of grief, revenge, and supernatural that really drive the plot throughout this novel. The woman in black, or Jeanette Humphrey, as I'll refer to her probably interchangeably just naturally, symbolizes unresolved grief and vengeance. Right? There's a stark vengeance in her soul. And she's covered in black clothing as a traditional symbol of mourning, representing her emotional torment and refusal to, quote-unquote, go to the other side, as we usually euphemize. As she traps children, it represents how she is trapped in her loss and reflects her own despair constantly. Like, she is constantly wallowing in her own despaired state. And Jeanette's manifestation as a ghost, because I don't necessarily think you can call her a spirit, she is more of a ghost who becomes a symbol of unresolved trauma. And I say she's more of a ghost because ghosts typically take on a physical, visual form, while spirits are more a soul of a person, especially in media. A spirit's usually like this flying orb or wisp, and then ghosts take on physical, personified qualities that we can see. So she is more of a ghost who becomes a symbol of this unresolved trauma, emphasizing how intense grief and vengeance can turn one into something destructive as she takes out her grief by killing innocent children. So we have this idea of an innocent who passed and was a victim, but she is now turned into this predator that is victimizing innocent children, therefore making her the ultimate motif for pure vengeance. She has become an ultimate Gothic archetype visually, both visually and metaphorically, I would say. Then we have the marshes and the mist, which serve as motifs for the themes of trauma and the supernatural. And I think a theme of trauma is maybe overlooked sometimes, especially in a horror Gothic film where visually the supernatural is just so interesting. But there's heavy trauma for multiple characters throughout the book and the film. And so the omnipresent mist that covers the landscape symbolizes and implements Gothic tropes of the unknown, contributing to the novel setting and representing the layers of secrets and hidden histories tied into the plot. Because we don't just have hidden histories of people, we have hidden histories of places in this sense. And so the marshes and the mist have become a motif for that theme of the supernatural and the unknown. The mist that covers the marshes creates a sense of disorientation and mystery, representing the unknown aspects of the tragedy of Jeanette Humphrey. And the mist is truly like an omnipresent force in my mind, really like a manifestation in the book. I feel like it's oftentimes treated like an entity in a lot of ways, but not directly personified, which is very interesting because we almost personify it subconsciously. And that emphasizes the physical and psychological conflicts throughout the story. The house's past and secrets are hidden beneath a fog of history and quite literally inside the marshes. And the marsh itself is really represented as like a spirit as it actively traps Eel Marsh House from the outside world. The marsh is physically and symbolically cut off the house, suggesting that some traumas, like Jeanette's, are difficult to escape or resolve. And mist also often symbolizes the boundary between physical and spiritual, like Stephen King's literal novel, The Mist. called The Mist. And so it has become a motif for these themes. And the mist and marshes together give a sense of the supernatural paralleling. And I know Stephen's going to talk a bit about how that works with characterization.
Almost like that's a parallel.
Great minds. And so there's this environment that almost makes sense that people would see ghosts, right? Providing some sort of subconscious credibility to the plot and themes of the supernatural. The marsh also induces this sort of claustrophobic feeling, creating a motif for the haunting power of the past. There is more of a recurring focus on the pony in the trap in the novella than in the film, as it's described more often physically. The sounds of the pony in the trap in the marshes are a symbol of Jeanette's trauma replaying endlessly, representing her inability to move on from the death of her son. This repetitive haunting suggests that traumatic experiences can become inescapable, creating a motif for the ever-present theme of sorrow in Jeanette's life. And then the nursery, which was one of my favorite descriptions in the book as well, was of the nursery because it was so incredibly detailed. The nursery at Eel Marsh House is a deeply symbolic space that serves as a motif for loss and grief, especially in Jeanette's mind. And also in Arthur's, as he is about to have a family and potentially have kids one day. This room is still furnished, waiting for a child who will never return, just like Jeanette is still waiting for her child that will never return. And so as Arthur explores the nursery, it's resurrected, in a sense, with noises and shadows, symbolizing how the past refuses to remain buried. Or perhaps how the dead never really left. I'm not sure. I like to think that maybe the dead never did leave and it's been alive this whole time. But we have this idea of resurrection when Arthur enters the house again. The room is a literal and figurative prison of memories, holding Jeanette's torment, ultimately symbolizing the loss of innocence and the lingering impact of the tragedy. And most likely a constant visual reminder for her that catalyzes her need to take the innocent children of others. Right. When she walks into that nursery, I imagine her seeing this nursery, seeing this image and immediately thinking, I need to go take a child. Like, she needs a child. The themes of grief and vengeance in particular become almost palpable through these symbols and motifs. Each symbol not only contributes to the novel's gothic mood, but also reinforces the themes of this unresolved trauma, which is really one of the biggest themes that I wanted to focus on. The imagery throughout The Woman in Black is so stark that settings like the marshes have become archetypal in their own right. Even time could serve as a motif in this story, because time itself is somewhat frozen in the town based on The Woman in Black. She is frozen people's passions and ambitions, and the children's time is also stolen from them constantly. And so even the aspect of time surrounding the story, surrounding the setting, is a motif for this theme of trauma.
It is funny that when you and I started talking about our separate close reads, how close, how much on the same page we were about some of these ideas. So what I'm going to look at is particularly the theme of isolation and how that is conveyed and how it is brought about within the film. But I'm also going to overlap on a lot of what you said as well. So I don't know if that's just us being on the same page so often because we are both trained to be literary critics, or if there's a clear read of the writers and directors of the film who pick up on these themes in the novel as well. But either way, there are a lot of very similar aspects to both the film and the book. So in particular, I'm going to look at isolation both for Arthur and for Jeanette Humphrey. Their disconnectedness takes on both a physical and psychological form, which, again, we're going to talk about the landscape. The inhospitable landscape of the Nine Life Causeways amplifies this. It's a very common trope when I teach Gothic, and I always have a Gothic unit in my Brit Lit class. I have this little PowerPoint that has characteristics of the Gothic, and the very first one is that the landscape and architecture becomes almost a character of itself, looming and sort of overpowering. You think about the moors of Wuthering Heights that separate the two houses, or in Dracula, both the Transylvanian landscape itself, but also Castle Dracula looming in the way that Harker has to make his way through that labyrinthine maze and get caught by the brides of Dracula and whatnot. That's always something that you see in a Gothic film. And even some people make the argument that Ridley Scott's Alien is a Gothic film, and that spaceship very much has the same sort of architecture. So the narrow tidal road that connects Arthur Kipps to the Ilmarsh house becomes more than just a path at that point. It becomes a boundary between these two worlds. One is the living world that Kipps belongs to, but as the tide rises, he has to confront the unknown, and it isolates him from any form of safety or community. Once the tide seals him in, he's left as vulnerable and at the mercy of this hostile space where he's confronted by the supernatural forces, which he can't comprehend or escape, although we did say that in the film he's a bit more susceptible. He's not quite as skeptical as he is in the novel. What really jumped out at me when he's at Ilmarsh House, though, is the way they use sound. You know, this is a sonic masterpiece in so many ways. Silence takes on a tangible and almost oppressive quality while he's at Ilmarsh House. I use this term, I couldn't seem to find this term in relation to film studies, but active silence. I don't think I made that up. I think it exists, and I just cannot find the person who says it. So if you know that scholar or you are that scholar, I'm not trying to steal from you. But I'm just going to go ahead and call this active silence and assume that I've read it somewhere in my mind as getting old and senile, and so I can't remember exactly who did that. But what I mean to say by active silence is there are these long stretches in the film where there's absolutely no dialogue, which is a very bold move. He may like say who's there or something, but there's no, you know, nobody's talking back to him. You might hear him talk to Spider, for instance, our favorite character. The dog.
For sure.
Or there's linguistic communication when he's reading some of the documents and it's, or he's reading the scrawl that Alice has written, presumably about Janet on some of those. So we see this, and it's interesting too that in a lot of films you'll have a character read that out loud, but we don't get that at all. You have to read yourself. He assumes you're at least 5 years old and know how to read. And I hope you're older than five if you're watching this film, or you're gonna have nightmares. It's a bold move, though, to forego that verbal interplay in the way that he does. But the silence itself is anything but passive. It's carefully constructed in this soundscape that becomes its own sinister character almost as well, like the landscape. Again, it amplifies Kipps' vulnerability, and it creates a mounting tension that neither speech nor a musical score could achieve. But we do have music, but it's not a traditional horror scoring. It uses these unsettling ambient sounds that blur the line between noise and music, right? And it all kind of merges with the creaks and groans and distant rattles in the house. The active silence serves as a constant reminder that Kipps is alone and unwelcome, but not unobserved. He's a prisoner of both the woman in black and the house itself. Was it our discussion of Stardust where I brought up diegetic and extra-diegetic sounds?
I think so.
Or maybe it was an episode of Shelf Criticism. I have no idea. I have thrown these terms out before, but just not to sound too snotty and film studies. We have the terms diegetic and either extra-diegetic or sometimes non-diegetic. Same thing when you hear one of those terms. It's a very simple concept. Diegetic noise or sound is what the characters will hear and we hear at the same time. So if someone knocks on a door and a person gets up to get it in a film, we heard the knock as the audience, they heard it, it's diegetic. Extra diegetic is sounds that the audience hears, but the characters within the film do not. So musical scores is the big example here. So we don't hear a lot of those cacophonous sounds that are, I'm going to just put air quotes over this, music. But the choice to emphasize diegetic sounds over the extra diegetic music really immerses the viewers in Kipps' experience of the house. Just as he's acutely aware of every minor sound, so are we. Each footstep, creaking floorboard, the howling wind, it all reinforces the isolation and creates a tactile experience of dread. Even the occasional strains of the extra diegetic music are cacophonous and fleeting, and they only break to add a brief layer of anxiety rather than any sense of emotional relief or narrative closure. When they do come, what's so interesting is it's not at that moment of the scare. It's building up to the scare, perhaps, or sometimes even after the scare. But it's the moment where you actually get the jump, it's just the sound itself that does that. It's as though each sound is a deliberate taunt that reminds Kipps that he's being watched by something malevolent and that escape is both improbable and undesired by whatever it is that's haunting him. The result of this active silence is an atmosphere that feels alive and in some ways more foreboding than any ghostly appearance. The soundscape almost replaces the woman in black, giving her a presence without requiring her physical manifestations. Just like the sounds are all around, you get the sense that she could be anywhere in the house, with her footsteps blending in with the shadows, or her gaze conveyed in each groaning hinge or rattling window. The silence is really her domain, the void that she fills with the unsettling sounds that remind Kipps of his entrapment. As I said before, the setting is also very powerful, but it becomes a metaphor for grief itself. It's almost like somebody else talked about metaphor. Kipps' isolation within the Ilmarsh house mirrors that of the woman in black's eternal entrapment in her own sorrow, and the rising tide could be seen as a symbol of grief in its all-consuming nature. Just as Arthur is physically cut off from help, he's forced to confront the weight of both his grief for his wife, but also the woman in black and her own endless mourning. In a sense, the Nine Lives Causeway becomes a threshold that divides the realm of life and death, and crossing it pulls Kipps deeper into her isolated world, where despair lingers like an infection that corrupts any hope of peace or escape. So furthermore, the causeway and the house contribute to the film's theme of doubling that we've just talked about. The isolation of Kipps' experience echoes the Woman in Black's. Both have suffered trauma, as you said. She too is bound to the house and cut off from life, unable to cross back into the world of the living, just like Kipps is stranded in her domain. In both the character and setting, the Woman in Black explores isolation as a state that isn't merely physical, but deeply psychological. The house, empty of human warmth, becomes a prison of loss and resentment, foreshadowing the toll her presence will exact on Arthur Kipps. In this way, the Woman in Black brilliantly intertwines the setting, sound, and theme to make Kipps' isolation feel like more than a distance. It's a spiritual quarantine, a preview of the same relentless sorrow that keeps the Woman in Black bound to the house. For Kipps, crossing the Nine Lives Crossway is more than entering a haunted house, but rather a brush with grief that's so overwhelming it threatens to consume him. It's a stark, icy reminder of the haunting forces we can't always escape, even in the silent spaces where we think we're safe.
And that's something I love to point out to my students, too, when we talk about really anything kind of scary or gothic, is that discomforting silence is so intentional. Pauses in works are so intentional because we are so uncomfortable with silence a lot of the time.
And you and our producer, Reagan, even though I didn't want you to, grabbed my master's thesis off the shelf, didn't you? And
we sure did.
Flipped through it.
It's good.
Which is all about narrative gaps and times where silence falls in and substitutes for whatever horror is there.
Yes.
So it's almost like I was preconditioned to make that reading. By the way, you don't want to read that thesis.
Yes, you do.
It's not
it's
good.
Very good.
It's not good. Before we delve any deeper into The Woman in Black, let's take a quick moment to thank today's sponsor, the Krithian Gifford Tourist Board.
Thinking about a peaceful getaway? Looking to get away from the bustle of city life? Krithian Gifford is just the ticket. Nestled on the scenic coast, this charming village offers tranquility and silence, almost unnaturally so. We guarantee there won't be the usual ruckus of children running through the streets, so you can enjoy all the solitude you like. Wonder why?
Start your journey with a scenic trek across the Nine Lives Causeway. Just be sure to check the tide charts. Don't want to find yourself stranded at Eel Marsh House after dark. Tourists rave that the house is full of character, though please note, most tours don't get beyond the front door.
And for those interested in local lore, stop by the Village Inn, where residents are happy to tell you tales of the town's storied history. Just don't ask too many questions. They're a private sort in these parts.
Enjoy other unique Krithian Gifford amenities, like the atmospheric cemetery, winding marsh trails, and a community that believes in minding your own business.
Krithian Gifford Tourist Board, where every visit is unforgettable, even if you try. On to my favorite. Do you just let me start this one on purpose?
I don't know. I try to switch it up where you start one segment, I start the next. I don't know. It just happens that way. Or maybe I just know you love it.
I do. Most hated character. And as long as we're discounting the actual Woman in Black. Okay, because, I mean, she's a child murderer. So I don't like her. You know, but we're just going to pretend like she doesn't exist.
We understand her motivation. She's a well-motivated villain that doesn't make it right.
Yes, right. I mean, you just have to dislike her. But in the movie, you know, in the novella, I don't have a strong stance on this. But in the movie, freaking Jerome. I don't like Jerome at all.
No.
The guy literally could have helped Arthur at any point or informed him of what is going on, but he doesn't. It's not a secret, you know? Also, he knows that Arthur is expecting his son to join him, and he still doesn't tell him anything. That's just messed up.
Yeah, please, don't send your son. That's all you have to say.
Yeah, just don't let him come here.
This town has cooties.
Yeah, tell him that. And I also dislike the husband slash innkeeper. I can't remember his name right now. But he's just very unfair to his wife. He's not very kind to her, and I know that he's gone through trauma as well, but I didn't really like his attitude. He didn't want to help Arthur in any way, shape, or form, and kind of brought up the trauma of losing their children to his wife in conversation, and I just didn't like that.
Yeah, and I like his wife. She seems like a nice person.
Yeah, she tries.
And she has a cute little minor bird in a cage.
Yeah.
Speaking of parallels, you notice you have that bird in the cage and then the raven or the crow that's in the bedroom trapped there in the Eel Marsh house. I agree with you. I just, again, The Woman in Black is the obvious choice. I racked my brain. I couldn't really think of another character. I do find it interesting. Like, I really like Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Good guy. I love Kieran Hines, anyway, the actor who plays him. Mm-hmm. He's a good guy. He helps Arthur out. He's, you know, he is the resident stereotypical skeptic, yes, but he's a likable person all the way around, which interests me because he's this wealthy fellow who kind of looks down on the townspeople, and he's the only one that has the automobile. It's almost like we should be conditioned to hate this guy, and we don't.
There's the briefest allusion to classism in the story.
It's also 1983.
Yeah.
In England, Thatcherism. Maybe we weren't thinking that way just yet.
Right. And you needed the car, right? It was a huge plot device. Right.
So I guess we'll move on to our academic style, enjoy, teach, and scholarship. Enjoy, it's a pseudo-Victorian Gothic story. How can I not enjoy it?
I have no idea.
It's
I agree.
Impossible for me, psychologically, to not enjoy this story. I like the book a lot. I love the film. Yay, kudos, good stuff.
Yep, I love it. I love the movie's ending better because, I mean, it's children. Like, I need the family to be together. You know, so just emotionally, I enjoyed the movie's ending. However, the book is perfectly pseudo-Victorian Gothic. I mean, it has every Gothic trope that I can think of off the top of my head. I do think it is masterfully done. Also, the plot is just generic enough to where you don't get lost, but it is also unique in so many little ways that differentiate it from other Gothic tales, like the plot development of the adoption. Right? We see this sort of adoptive or foster parent element in a lot of scary movies now, but I can't think of another pre-21st century Gothic story that has this huge maternal conflict at the center of the Gothic plot.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point because, you know, another common characteristic of Gothic films is that you have some sort of disempowered person, usually it's a woman, who is in peril and mm-hmm. usually by a villain who has power of some sort. Clearly, there is the children in this case, right, who are powerless and who are in danger. But there's also that subplot of, you know, she got pregnant out of wedlock.
Right.
It's no big deal. We all went to high school with, 14 kids who did that nowadays. But obviously, that was a very big deal at the time. It caused shame to the family, putting air quotes in that. You can't see it. You know, they would send people away to have the child. And then think of that line in, is it Barn Burning by Faulkner? It's Spotted Horses. On Faulkner, where he talks about one of the Snopes kids going away with his and getting married, and the kid comes back, he's supposed to be 8 months old, and he's already pulling up on chairs. He says, I reckon in a couple of years, if he keeps growing, he'll be spitting tobacco like the rest of us.
That is a funny scene.
Yeah, so I mean, these things that we all know happen, you know, the adoption and where it came from. I'm sure the townspeople knew all this too, but it draws attention to something. I think that's a very 21st century idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or 20th century. I don't think that if this were a 1920s novel that plot point would really be hit in the way that it is. So that alone kind of does bring it a little bit modern, even though it still feels like a thoroughly old story.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty multi-generational, I feel like. It's a timeless plot, I think. And then as for teaching it, absolutely, you could teach this novella in a literature class. I would say upper high school and college courses because there are some very intense thematic elements, particularly with the trauma. And this story can honestly be very scary because of the traumatic plot development and characterization.
Do you know that in the UK this is very commonly assigned at our equivalent of like a 7th, 8th grade level?
That's crazy to me.
Yeah, I can't imagine being like 12 years old and reading this book.
I know.
I'd be worried. Make me do it. For my child. I have to take a quiz on this? I can't sleep.
But I do think that showing the film at the same time could also be confusing, even though I think the film would help students in a lot of ways become more engaged with it. I think it could confuse students since there are distinct motivational differences, especially in Arthur. Right? While teaching the novella, I would focus on Gothic criticism and archetypal characterization, as I do. Definitely analyzing how the archetype of the Woman in Black has inspired other images in horror over these last 40 years. And deep dive into the symbolism of names, terminology, and motifs like Eel Marsh House and the Nine Lives Causeway. However, it could be really interesting to compare and contrast the novella with the movie in like a literature and film class afterwards, I think.
Yeah, as for me, it's a pseudo-Victorian Gothic story. How could I not teach it? In all seriousness, I have taught it. it makes a really good selection for our English 212, we call it here, British Lit Part 2. I taught it once along with a big unit on the Gothic, and the students really seemed to enjoy it, even though a few of them, I mentioned at 12 years old, at 19 and 20, some of my students came here like, this is scaring me, dude. I'm getting nightmares. As for the film, I did show some clips during the discussion, but we've talked about this with other films. We just don't have time in class to stop and show an entire film. It would make a really good film to show in a film studies class. It's just so well directed. I think it would be a good choice. And we do offer a class in the horror film, which I'm guessing Sydney is going to be the one taking over now that our previous professor who taught it has retired.
Who will be a guest star in the coming months?
Yes, he's coming up. So, Sydney, if you're listening, throwing that out there. By the way, unrelated, but did you see that he's teaching a class on martial arts films in the spring?
Which is incredible.
I want to take that so bad.
Yes. Oh, it'll be great.
Why am I still not a student? As for scholarship, it's a pseudo-Victorian Gothic story. How could I not study it? But yeah, I did make mention of it in my master's thesis, which dealt specifically, as I said before, with 19th century literature. And I mostly just noted it as part of a legacy of that era's influence. But hey, those ACETA proposals are due, was it November 15th?
Yep.
And I haven't even thought about what to do. You mentioned the naming earlier. There are a lot of references to animals. Mm-hmm. Eel Marsh, Nine Lives Causeway, our favorite character in the film, Spider, who's a dog.
Yes.
Awesome. Maybe there's something there. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, you should definitely go with that, I think.
I got to go with something. I got to get a proposal out. That's 2 weeks away.
Yeah, I mean, definitely multiple avenues of literary criticism to explore here. Specifically, I could see analyzing this film through the lens of psychoanalytic criticism, particularly with Arthur Kipps, or the novella through Gothicism, as many scholars have done thus far. As I am partial to archetypal criticism, I would like to potentially further explore the idea of the woman in black as an archetype of both the fallen woman and as the harbinger of death. I just feel like she is much more multifaceted than is often portrayed. A lot of times, especially in horror, when something is evil, particularly a spirit, it's just evil with an empathetic backstory, right? But she has multiple facets to her personality as well. It's not often that you see an evil maternal figure that wishes children harm. And I just think that that makes her such an interesting archetype.
It does seem in some ways be an oxymoron, but I think that's what grief does to you.
Yeah.
Pushes you to want to harm the innocent because your innocent was harmed, even though it was inadvertent. The WTF moment. So this is a film that's not afraid, and I don't mean a pun there. I really don't mean a pun there. It's not afraid to go for the jump scares. A lot of times I poo-poo that and think it's cheap, but in this case I don't. Even the fake-outs. There are some fake-outs. We mentioned the crow in the upper bedroom. The one that really got me, though, was, you know, when he goes back downstairs and, you know, those little, what do they call them, carousel lanterns?
Yes.
That they used to have back in the Victorian age. He takes one and he kind of spins it and just absentmindedly and he looks down in it. And you see the little flickering slits as it's passing by and then suddenly there's an eyeball there.
Yeah.
Just looking back at him. I'd seen this film many times before. I guess I'd forgotten about that moment. And I'm generally just, I've seen so many horror films, I'm callous and immune to jump scares. I know when they're coming. That one just got me for some reason.
Yeah. I knew it was coming and I was still off put.
Yeah, when that moment hit, like, I really tensed up. And I may have even uttered a couple of words my mother told me a long time ago that I shouldn't say. But then again, you know, I sent you a text, right? I was sitting outdoors with a fire going in the dark watching this on my iPad.
Which at is nighttime.
Probably not the best idea.
Setting the scene.
Kind of courting those scares, wasn't I?
A little bit. And so in the film, two things. First, I was like, why on earth are you not sending a telegram to your son and nanny to not come? Because he mentioned sending a telegram to his work. So it's like, why are you not sending one to your son? Honestly, should have been the first thing he did after going to the house for the first time. If not, even before that, when he had an altercation with multiple townspeople. Similarly, at the very end with the train station, how are you going to let go of your child's hand after everything you just went through? I understand he thought she was gone. I understand a lot was going on in the moment. But still, how did this not scar you for life so that you had your eyes on your child for at least the next week, constantly? The moment his hand left Arthur's, as in the child's hand left Arthur's, I sat up in my seat and said, nuh-uh. Like, honestly. I mean, how dare the director do that to me? I was so straight-backed, just baffled. Oh, it made me so sad.
Says the woman who still has no children.
You'll
have children one day, and you'll let their hand go, and they'll be lost in the shopping mall.
No! So it's just it a terrifying thought.
It really does. You think you watch them, and then you don't. And gosh, they're so annoying. Sometimes you're glad they're missing. I'm joking.
if your son is listening.
I just get a few minutes of peace. That's all I'm saying. We want to find you. Just let you hide under one of those clothing racks for a few minutes. As for the geek outs, I've already talked about the Sonic experience and the way they use the active silence. And that was my biggest geek out. For the book, again, I know I talked about this earlier, but it's the pseudo-gothic nature. It is just so reminiscent of the novels that were written at that time. When you say to me, this was written in the 80s, I almost think 1880s, mm-hmm. not 1980s, except for the automobile.
Right.
And even that automobile, if nobody had told me and I read this, I would say, okay, 1920s, maybe early 30s, but I would not think it would be any later than that. It's just, she clearly has read much, much gothic, and she knows how to emulate and write in that style. And I'm very impressed by that. I love the way that was set up.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I agree with the music Sonic score geek out completely. I thought it was masterfully done. I love a movie when there's not much dialogue because it's so artfully done in other ways. So I really enjoyed that too. So this is pretty morbid, but I love the opening scenes in the film with the girls and the tea party. I love the tea party aesthetic and imagery. I love the absence of actual tea where it is this imaginary trope. So there's an imaginary concept of seeing things that aren't really there already in these children.
That's what immediately got my attention. You can't really tell if it's a child-sized pretend cup or not at first, but when they tilt it and nothing comes out into the cup, you're like, oh, these are kids playing.
I loved it. And then there is this sudden shift in the girl's demeanor and focus that is just so unnerving. The fact that they don't speak also sets the tone very well.
Silence.
Right? No dialogue, that's silence. Then there's the visual of the three girls and the three windows. And, you know, ordinarily three symbolizes completion and life, but in this case, it centers around destruction and death. And the light is just so bright in the room coming through these windows that it also is a juxtaposition to the events. And when the girls jump out of the windows, it tears your heart out and immediately just enraptures you into the story. It was just such a moving first scene, even if it was morbid and depressing.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I really love how in the film so much of the supernatural activity happens in daylight. Another kind of with the sound music score, it's just different, and I really liked it. In the novella, there is more of a focus on the nighttime, which is typical, you know, makes sense. But I love the change of visuals in the film. It is so much more immobilizing and terrifying to think about these supernatural occurrences happening in the daytime when it's meant to be safe for us. Though I could also see how that's an aesthetically smart choice so that the woman in black stands out even more in daylight.
It's such a great observation. There's an entire subgenre of horror known as daylight horror. And we've discussed some of them on our podcast. Jaws falls into that. So does The Birds. I don't know that we actually said that term on either of those episodes. But there are some other well-known films, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Midsommar, a lot of the new ones, the so-called elevated horror. Midsommar, The Witch, Hereditary, It Follows, Us. I got to throw some Rob Zombie in there because I love him. The Devil's Rejects is a total daylight horror. I could go on. There is some fog cover, and the book really makes big of the fog. The film only does in really one moment. But the fog cover maybe obscures some of that daylight, but so much of it just is in the bright, shining sun. And I think there's something inherently scary about that. Because like you said, in most horror films, the daylight at least provides respite. You know you're not going to get haunted in the daylight. There's a break. We can breathe for a moment. But if it's daytime horror, the threat is omnipresent. There's no escaping.
And thinking about Jaws in this as well, and it's interesting that the Jaws and the Birds, they focus on animal-type horror. But also the first scene in Jaws where someone is killed is at nighttime.
Is it night? That's a good point.
Is that a night swim? Yep. Just interesting.
I'm thinking The Birds. I don't know that there's a night scene.
When she's in the house, when she gets fully attacked in the attic, it's nighttime.
You're right.
So maybe like the big moments.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Another thought for us to...
Something else to...
dwell on.
To think about. Any other? Nothing else in the script.
I mean, we could talk about it, you know, all day. So you mentioned in the book this focus on fog. And there is this moment in the book where Arthur, he's so excited to get out of the fog of London. You know, and he's like, oh, I get to go on this trip, and he's on the train, and he's loving the scenery, and then he gets to the town, and it's covered in fog. And I feel bad for him in that moment, but in a way, that's also telling of how he's not going to be able to escape worries of his life just because he's going to a different location.
That's a good point. It's that trauma that's there from losing his wife that's just, well, no, that's the book, though. Never mind.
No, you're right. In the movie, they don't focus on the fog quite as much, which is also interesting. And maybe, you know, part of that's to see our characters more clearly in visuals.
That's true. We have to be able to see them.
Yeah.
I guess that's a wrap.
And I am looking forward to next month because I have neither read nor seen the book/film that we are doing. We're doing Like Water for Chocolate. I can't remember the author's name off the top of my head.
Laura Esquivel.
Stephen has seen the film before.
I'm actually looking to see the date of publication. I'm just curious.
1989.
So the 1989 book, Like Water for Chocolate, or if you really want to be fancy, Como Agua para Chocolate.
Ooh, fancy.
That's about all I can speak in Spanish. But yeah, it was written in 1989, translated into English in 1992, I believe, in conjunction with the film being released. It is a foreign language film, but I believe that was 1992 as well. I read the book. It was maybe early grad school. It was at the very latest, it was like 2000, 2001 perhaps. So it's been a quarter century since I've read the book. It's been a little less since I've seen the film. I've seen it a couple of times, but I'm very excited for going back to it. I remember really, really enjoying it. And there's some unique stuff in this book. So if you've not read it, highly recommend you get your hands on it. The film is streaming on Pluto TV,
yes,
was it?
Pluto for free.
So you can get that for free. No excuse. Do your homework.
Yeah, and I'm very excited. I love multicultural, bilingual text. It's always very enriching, and so I'm very excited to learn a lot as well through reading and watching the film.
And you got that new thing about magic realism that you're interested in.
Ah, yes.
This is one of those genres, so.
I love some magic realism.
You're going to have fun with that. Also in November, right? Late November. After
late November.
Esteemed producer defends her thesis.
She'll be amazing.
She will be, I have no doubt.
Reagan Babb, she's joining us.
Yes, she will be joining us for a very special edition. Crossover, shelf criticism, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do, but it's Owls of Palace.
We're going to get to hate on the lowest grossing movie of all time.
That's right. We'll be hooting about Zizek Road, which made a grand total of?
$30.
And stars Katherine Heigl and Tom Sizemore. This is not just some bad student film that somehow got distributed.
I feel bad for them. $30 in the box office. Two tickets refunded, right?
Right. He reimbursed two tickets to the director. So technically, net $20. It's made a lot since then. Mm-hmm. Off of this infamy. And there is a reason. There's a story behind it. We'll be telling all of that on that special edition. Look for that, right at the end of November? Early December?
Yep. And then we also definitely need to tell them about your Shelf Criticism podcast, Halloween episode.
Sodes. Plural. Sodes. Many of them. Yeah. After you've gotten your Halloween fix listening to The Woman in Black, why don't you pop on over to Shelf Criticism? Let's see. We did Mirrors, the Kiefer Sutherland ghost story. Van Helsing, which is not a horror, but it is certainly Halloween themed. Dracula, the Wolfman, Frankenstein's Monster. Then I did an Animal Attack horror, Rogue.
Oh. Naturally. Right.
Animal Attack there, Lion. Lords of Salem. Like I said, just had to get a Rob Zombie in there. That one's creepy as heck. And then, yes, I just did Scream 6. So the latest edition of that, I'll talk about it as well. So there you go. You got five more Halloween podcasts to listen to before the spooky season is completely over.
Season finale.
And the season finale is coming up probably next week.
Awesome.
It's been a crazy week. I hope I can get back in the studio to record that. We'll be talking about the 2003 film Confidence. Ed Burns, Dustin Hoffman, Rachel Weisz. You know I love a good con movie. This one is literally named Confidence.
Well, y'all definitely need to go give a listen to Stephen's Shelf Criticism podcast, as well as subscribe and like to our podcast on social media if you haven't already. And you can find us on Instagram or Facebook at Real Lit Podcast. And that's R-E-E-L as in real movie reel. Lit, L-I-T, podcast.
Also, you could email us if you want to do it the old-fashioned way. reallit@reallitpodcast.com.
I love a good email. Good old-fashioned
please,
email.
Please, send us some. Even if it's hate mail.
No! Right, well, as we close, Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Reagan Babb. Our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala. And for Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Stephen. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning.
That was loud.
I'm sorry. Apologize.
You can wear these headphones next time.
I got excited.